Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the much-anticipated deal of the century promised by President Trump and his son-in-law Jared Kushner to be finally unveiled in Bahrain on Tuesday and Wednesday at a downgraded summit now billed as an economic workshop at which neither of the parties to the proposed Israeli-Palestinian peace plan will be in attendance. Khaled El-Gindi, a non-resident fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution, who served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel and is the author of Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians from Balfour to Trump, joins us to discuss Jared's dead-on-arrival peace plan. With Kushner offering the Palestinians a promise of $50 billion in investments, which no country, including the United States, has actually put a penny of on the table, we will assess whether there is really a plan for an actual Palestinian state or whether Kushner's plan is meant to codify Israel's annexation of Palestinian territory. With Israel's ambassador to the UN, Danny Danon, in an op-ed in the New York Times suggesting the Palestinian leadership should accept the national suicide of their current political and cultural ethos in the hope that their surrender would result in the same kind of treatment the defeated Germans and Japanese received from the United States after their surrender in World War II, we'll look into how this offer might strike the Palestinians. Then we will speak with Liesl Hintz, who is a professor of international relations at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, whose latest book is Identity Politics Inside Out, National Identity Contestation and Foreign Policy in Turkey. She joins us to discuss the mayoral elections in Istanbul, which were a rerun of a recent defeat for President Erdogan, but this time he suffered an even greater rebuke, having previously said that whoever wins Istanbul wins Turkey. We'll assess whether the trajectory Erdogan has taken Turkey on towards autocracy away from democracy is now being reversed. Then finally, we'll get an economic analysis of the impact of Bernie Sanders' plan announced today to cancel all $1.6 trillion of student loan debt held by 45 million Americans. Marshall Steinbaum, professor of economics at the University of Utah and the co-author of a recent report at the Levy Economics Institute, The Macroeconomic Effects of Student Debt Cancellation, joins us to discuss how the Sanders plan, paid for with higher taxes on the richest Americans, would unleash billions of dollars in economic growth. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Khaled El-Gindi, a non-resident fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009 and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. And his latest book is Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians from Balfour to Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, Khaled El-Gindi.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. And what do you make of this meeting underway starting tomorrow in Bahrain? It's been downgraded from a summit, now billed as an economic workshop.
Right.
It's supposed to be the unveiling of the deal of the century, which has been promised by President Trump and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, to bring about Middle East peace. But this gathering in Bahrain, neither Israel or Palestine are sending a delegation. So it's right. Not exactly getting off to an auspicious start.
No, it's not. But it's also not entirely surprising. I think most informed observers of the situation had a sense that this was a process that was going to end up being downgraded. As you said, it went from being a summit to a workshop, but even a workshop implies that there are relevant technical people who are participating, and of course there are no Palestinians participating, not business leaders, at least not any with any credibility. I think there is one sole Palestinian who is attending, but he's someone who is thoroughly discredited in the business community and certainly politically. And so if you have no, as you said, if there's no Palestinian participation, there's no Israeli participation, it's really not much of a workshop. But more specifically, we have the details now of the vision, this economic vision that Jared Kushner and the Trump administration have for the Palestinians. It was just published over the weekend, a 50-page document outlining all kinds of ambitious economic development programs. But it really is, I mean, I think it's important to sort of stay up front. This whole exercise in Bahrain is a distraction. It's not relevant in the sense that there are no Palestinians there who are supposedly the beneficiaries of this project. But it's also kind of a lot of smoke and mirrors, because it's not as if these are programs that will, you know, it's not an economics first approach like a lot of people are referring to it as. An economics first approach means, you know, we're going to build up the Palestinian economy in the present, in the interim, until we reach a final status agreement at some point, a political arrangement down the road. But as a step toward that, we're working on improving the Palestinian economy. That's not what this is. This is a kind of pie in the sky. All of these projects, about $50 billion worth of projects over 10 years, it's kind of a wish list of all the things that could happen if Palestinians sign on to the political component of the Trump plan, which has now been delayed many times over the last 2 years. And so it's kind of contingent on Palestinians buying into their political vision. And we already kind of know, they haven't published the details of their political vision, but we know the general outlines. I think we know enough. There is no Jerusalem. Jerusalem is off the table, in the words of President Trump, since the administration recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital. There's the refugee issue is not on the table also. The administration is busy trying to redefine Palestinian refugees, essentially to define them out of existence. And at the same time, they've cut all funding to the UN agency that provide services to Palestinian refugees. So refugees is off the table. And the biggest issue, or at least the issue that's most relevant to Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, there is no sovereign Palestinian state or an end to the Israeli occupation. Those are not on the agenda as far as we know. After 2.5 years in office, the administration has never alluded to a sovereign Palestinian state or an end to Israeli occupation. And so that's really the reason that Palestinians are not buying into the political program, much less the economic vision, or I should say they're not buying into the economic vision, much less the political program, because they're tied together. And what is on offer for the Palestinians is essentially, if you give up on your dream of independence and sovereignty and self-determination and freedom, then there's the possibility that you could get these $50 billion of projects, a lot of which, frankly, is money that is going to host Arab countries in the region, like Egypt and Jordan and Lebanon, and will never even go to Palestinians. So it's a tall order. But I think it's pretty clear that the workshop is not appealing to Palestinians because it doesn't deal with the number one issue, which is about Palestinian freedom.
And again, I'm speaking with Khaled El-Gindi, a non-resident fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009 and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November of 2007. And his latest book is Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians from Balfour to Trump. Well, the $50 billion that was promised on Saturday by Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, it's a promise of $50 billion in investments, but no country has actually put a penny on the table. And you just pointed out that most of it will probably go to other Arab countries. But what I find particularly extraordinary, and there's a likelihood that the second part of it, the political part of it, will essentially be a codification of Israel's annexation of Palestinian territory, certainly not a Palestinian state. But what did you make of the op-ed in the New York Times by Israel's ambassador to the UN, Danny Danon, which suggests that the Palestinian leadership should accept a national suicide of their current political and cultural ethos in the hope that their surrender would result in the same kind of treatment the defeated Germans and Japanese received from the United States after their surrender in World War II?
Yeah, I would say two things. First, it's entirely within the character of this very, very right-wing, extreme Israeli government to engage in that kind of extreme rhetoric. This is a government that is triumphalist. They are feeling incredibly powerful, and with that, of course, comes the arrogance of that power. They've got the full support of the American administration, unreserved support by the Americans. Much more, the United States, of course, has always leaned towards Israel in this conflict, and we've seen that manifested in different ways. But this is the first time that we've seen virtually a blank check from Washington for the maximalist positions of what is a very right-wing Israeli government. So on the one hand, this is a reflection of that triumphalism. We won, Palestinians are defeated, you should just accept whatever concessions we might, whatever consolation prize we might get you. And I think we need to see Bahrain in that context of as something like a consolation prize for having been defeated. The second point I would make, and this is something that I emphasize in the book, this idea of Palestinian political aspirations as inherently extreme, as being almost something like a pathology that needs to be corrected or cured, is something we see in the Zionist movement quite a bit, not surprisingly, because if you're looking at Palestinian politics through the lens of the Zionist movement, well, then Palestinian demands are simply unreasonable and irrational. And the same is true if you look at Israeli politics through the lens of Palestinian nationalism. But what's really remarkable is that that view of Palestinian politics as pathology is quite prominent, not just in Israel, but even in American politics. And you see it especially in Republican circles. Even before the Trump administration, the George W. Bush administration was a very big proponent of this notion that Palestinian politics and so-called political culture is defective. Merely talking about Palestinian right of return, for example, for refugees, or Jerusalem as Palestinian capital, these were seen as signs of intransigence and signs of extremist thinking, if not in some cases maybe even seen as incitement. And so this view is quite prominent, and it's one reason why, as I explain in the book, that American mediation has been so deeply flawed, because it's emphasized really the wrong things. It's focused on trying to reform Palestinian politics, which, as I said, is seen as kind of inherently flawed, and on the other hand, to reassure Israel. And so what ended up happening is that the United States has kind of reversed the traditional mediation model. Instead of putting pressure on the stronger party and boosting the weaker party, the United States did the opposite of putting pressure on the weaker party. And so that really increased the already pretty significant power asymmetry between the two sides and reinforced the status quo. And so when we talk about the collapse of the peace process, we're talking about, at least I'm arguing, that this, you know, the peace process collapsed and basically died many years ago under President Barack Obama's watch. And what Trump is doing is sort of capitalizing on the absence and the death of the Oslo process to embark on an entirely different path geared more towards normalizing Israeli annexation, as you pointed out.
Well, at the end of the day, of course, the only good that might come out of this is finally, bursting the bubble that Jared Kushner is anything to be, is somebody that could be possibly taken seriously. I mean, the new book by Michael Wolff, Siege, is pretty damning in the portrayal of somebody that Bannon refers to as him and his wife Ivanka as a pair of grifters, but apparently what he's been doing in office since he got into that White House was essentially appealing to all the despots and kleptocrats around the world, saying, look, you know, you don't have to deal with the State Department, the Defense Department, the American government bureaucracy. You can deal directly with me. I'm a part of a family company. That's exactly music to the ears of all these crooks like Erdogan and Putin and Xi and the whole band. So it's a really sorry state of affairs, frankly, that Jared Kushner represents. So
it really is. But at the same time, I will say one kind of bright spot is that there's almost no one in Washington, in terms of analysts and, you know, the mainstream media, who takes this process, this Kushner plan, seriously. And that's very different than what we've seen in the past. In the past, it was always, you know, anything that Washington would produce, even if people were skeptical, you have to take it seriously because it's coming from from an American administration. But that's different now. There's probably two analysts who I'm not going to name in all of Washington who have gone out publicly and sort of talked about this plan as though it were serious. The rest, frankly, I think, it's not uncommon to, you know, I get calls from journalists who literally will ask me about the so-called peace plan, or they'll send me an email with peace plan in quotation. So there's a real, I think, there's a pretty pervasive understanding that this is not a serious effort. This is not something that can be taken seriously. So that's kind of a bright spot, because then that creates an opportunity to talk about what a real and credible peace process would entail, talking about the Israeli occupation and sort of refocusing on the main issues. And there's a lot more openness, I think, to hearing that than there has been in the past.
Well, Khaled Al-Ghindi, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Khaled Al-Ghindi, a non-resident fellow at the Center for Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He previously served as an advisor to the Palestinian leadership on permanent status negotiations with Israel from 2004 to 2009, and was a key participant in the Annapolis negotiations launched in November 2007. And his latest book is Blind Spot, America and the Palestinians from Balfour to Trump. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the stinging rebuke that Erdogan was handed in the mayoral elections in Istanbul. السيارة وهويتك وين رايح من وين جاي شو قضيتك فقدت حالك خلصت هيني جيتك تعيش بدون حواجز مش حتتحقق أمنيتك رصد السيارة وهويتك وين رايح من وين جاي شو قضيتك فكرت حالك خلصت هيني جيتك تعيش بدون حواجز مش حتتحقق أمنيتك انسرقنا من أرضنا بلدنا انغلبنا عحالنا انقلبنا اقنعونا وتدربنا نحمي إسرائيل من حالنا صرنا ممسوكين عساكر وين مكان بس اللي كل هاد لمين وين وين وين الملايين وين الملايين اللي بدنا تحرر فلسطين Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Liesl Hintze, who is the Professor of International Relations at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, who studies the intersection of identity politics and foreign policy with a focus on Turkey and the Greater Middle East. And her latest book is Identity Politics Inside Out, National Identity Contestation and Foreign Policy in Turkey. Welcome to Background Briefing, Liesl Hintze.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you. And it does seem like there was a major rebuke handed to President Erdogan in the mayoral elections in Istanbul. I believe at some point earlier, Erdogan himself had made the remark that he who wins Istanbul wins Turkey. So could this be a harbinger for a reversal of the trajectory that Turkey's been on under Erdogan, this drift towards autocracy away from democracy?
Well, the opposition victory in Istanbul is clearly a sign that there's a lot of discontent. There's been an immense amount of discontent, a push back against the sort of increasing authoritarian control that Erdogan has consolidated within the executive, that he has sort of consolidated within other institutions as well. You know, you saw the Gezi Park protests in 2013. You had a justice march in 2017. You had an opposition candidate run with support from a number of different opposition parties in the presidential election last year. But none of those were successful, and some of those were quashed. And so I think the fact that the opposition candidate, Ekrem İmamoğlu, delivered such a resounding victory, and the fact that this was a rerun of an election that the AKP didn't believe had been carried out under democratic terms, the fact that he wins by almost 10% is an enormous rebuke. Whether or not this is symbolic of a rollback of autocracy or a rollback of the authoritarian regime is really going to depend on how the AKP government reacts to this particular victory.
But isn't it likely that the fact that the last election didn't go Erdogan's way, that it wasn't so much a decision on the part of the AKP party, but him, because he's got a massive ego, doesn't he? I mean, he just simply couldn't believe he got defeated because he's been on a roll since 2003, right?
Sure. You know, I think it is fair to say that he does have a very large ego. You know, he paints himself as the man of the people, the man of the nation. A lot of people who vote don't even say they're voting for the AKP. They say that they're voting for him. You know, they call him their leader, their captain, and so forth. Although whether or not the decision was his, that is to rerun the Istanbul election, having lost by a small margin on March 31st, is up for debate. There are rumors, there are discussions that perhaps it was Devlet Bahçeli, who is the leader of the smaller, the junior coalition party that is in the AKP's coalition. There are rumors that some of Erdogan's very powerful advisors told him that this was the best course of action to take. You're absolutely right that losing Istanbul is a major blow to him. I mean, it's, you know, if from a symbolic perspective, it's where he got his start as mayor in the 90s. It's, you know, an immense source of rents for handing out in terms of political patronage. It's a third the size, its economy is a third of that of Turkey itself. And it's also the case that, you know, this has been run by the AKP since 2002, and there's likely some shady deals that are in the books now that the opposition has the chance to open those. So there was a lot of incentives for him to try to win this back, but it became quite clear, according to polls, that that wasn't going to happen.
Well, he made an effort, or his party made an effort to win over the Kurdish voters, which seemed to me to be tilting at windmills, surely. I mean, he's been so hostile to the Kurds, and particularly to the notion of any kind of Kurdish autonomy on the southern border, whether it's in Syria or in northern Iraq.
Very much so. Although it's worth noting that in between sort of 2012 to 2015, there was a solution process or a peace process that the AKP had instigated with the Kurds, and that was direct negotiations with the Kurdistan Workers Party, the PKK, and with Abdullah Öcalan, who is the leader of the PKK, who is in jail. It's certainly the case that after the Kurds were not, in Erdogan's eyes, seen as a trustworthy ally. In fact, the Kurds took away the AKP's parliamentary majority for the very first time in 2015, that he did turn his back on them. He drifted over to the Nationalist Action Party. That's this ultra-right conservative junior coalition partner, and reinitiated the war with the PKK. So I think it's not surprising that his outreaches to the Kurds fell extremely flat. And, you know, this idea that just by releasing a letter that Abdullah Öcalan had wrote telling Kurds that they should remain neutral, that is, that they should not vote for the opposition coalition. You know, I think a lot of Kurds saw that as the AKP once again, or Erdogan once again, trying to control them and didn't listen to that. I think it was impressive that the leader of the People's Democratic Party, that's the pro-Kurdish Liberal Democratic Party, Selahattin Demirtas, who was also in jail, sort of pushed back against that and didn't like the idea of Kurds being told what to do by Erdogan. So I think it's no surprise that they weren't willing to do his bidding.
And again, I'm speaking with Liesl Hintz, who is a professor of international relations at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, who studies the intersection of identity politics and foreign policy with a focus on Turkey and the greater Middle East. Her latest book is Identity Politics Inside Out, National Identity Contestation and Foreign Policy in Turkey. So in terms of Turkey's divide between the secular and the religious, which the AKP certainly does have a rural constituency that's pious, and Erdogan, of course, has tried to impose or reimpose piety on a traditionally, at least in the modern era, traditionally secular state. I would assume that Istanbul has a majority of secular voters. Would I be correct?
Well, it used to be that that was partially the case, but you've had a mass influx of sort of domestic migrants, that is, workers coming from the more rural Anatolian areas. So Istanbul actually has a very large percentage of conservative voters as well as Kurdish voters, because some of those coming from the southeast are obviously Kurdish. There's a number of quite pious districts within Istanbul, so even that large city itself is sort of fragmented. What I think is interesting about Ekrem İmamoğlu is that he's bridging those traditional, secular pious divides. It's never quite as black and white and clear cut as that. But he comes from a conservative background, and he is able to reach out to some of those pious conservative voters who are immensely frustrated at the fact that the AKP has been spending, but that money is not necessarily going to the people. In fact, he invoked the concept of israf, which is waste, and that is something that does not sit well with a pious conservative population that believes that waste, that is, you know, a bloated public service sector for Erdogan, a 1,100-room palace, huge expense budgets and so forth, that's not appropriate. That should be going to the people. So İmamoğlu actually was able to win some of those incredibly pious neighborhoods within Turkey, like Fatih, like Üsküdar, that in the past would very much have voted for the AKP. So I think it's really become a factor of disillusionment in the AKP's traditional conservative base.
Well, there's the old Samuel Johnson adage that patriotism is the last refuge of the scoundrel. And I think in today's world, with so many kleptocracies around the world and democracies under attack by despotic rulers, that you could revise that adage to piety or religion is the last refuge of the scoundrel. I mean, Erdogan and his family are just making money hand over a fist, which is, you know, the same, for example, in Iran. The supreme leader, who's God's representative on earth, is a multi-billionaire. So he stays in power because of the piety of the Revolutionary Guard Corps. But the best thing that ever happened to Erdogan was this botched coup attempt, surely. He's been able to milk that enormously, hasn't he? But are the people getting tired of it now? I mean, he's jailed so many people, particularly educators and lawyers. And journalists. I mean, he's been absolutely ruthless in terms of suppressing the press. So would you rate his popularity in terms of him being the martyr for that coup.
Right. So, I mean, I think I would even extend it to say that identity politics in general is sort of his refuge. We know that Turkey's been going through an economic crisis. Turkey, Erdogan specifically, likes to blame Western nefarious, nebulous foreign agents for that, and specifically the U.S. He obviously has a lot of animosity towards the U.S. because the U.S. refuses to extradite Fethullah Gulen, who is the religious preacher that Erdogan blames for the coup attempt in 2016. But, you know, his base wasn't just pious conservative people. There was a large section of the population that, at least in the initial years, was happy to see a bit of the rollback of the role of the military, a bit of a relaxation of some of those secularist institutions. But it's also the case that, as he did when he was mayor of Istanbul, he presided over tangible economic growth. And that is what a lot of people were voting for as well. So it was not just the pious and the conservative, although he does tell a narrative of being, again, this man of the people. He comes from Kasımpaşa, which is a, you know, lower socioeconomic neighborhood in Istanbul. He's a pious person himself. He went to a preacher training school. So he was able to tell that narrative of, you know, I was a victim. I was put in jail by the secularist military regime. I've come back to represent you all. And I think that that resonated for a long time. But as you say, after this, you know, the immense purges that took place following the coup attempt, which I do agree. I mean, Erdogan even called it a gift from God, and he was able to purge hundreds of thousands of individuals. There's, again, this huge sense of disillusionment that this is gone from trying to, you know, purify or cleanse these institutions of potential Gulen supporters, again, who is the person Erdogan blames for the coup attempt, and that this is just a greedy grab for power. So I do think that there's a lot of people who have lost faith in that AKP project.
So given that there's friction with the United States, although I don't think Trump necessarily doesn't get on with him in the sense that Trump is transactional and doesn't care about whether this guy's a kleptocrat, because Trump himself, his business background is pretty shady. Mm-hmm. And there have been various hotel deals with members of Erdogan's family with the Trump Organization. So they're heading they're going to be meeting up at the G20. Do you think, I mean, the friction is over the sale that Erdogan wants to buy Russian ground-to-air missiles, and the U.S. is saying, no, you have to buy the Patriot missiles because we're not going to give you the F-35s if you buy Russian equipment, because that is a NATO rule and you're a member of NATO, although not necessarily in good standing. So what do you think is going to happen there with a somewhat wounded Erdogan showing up at the G20 to meet with Trump?
Well, one of the problems in the U.S.-Turkey relationship has been the fact that what happens between the leaders doesn't necessarily translate into what happens on the ground. So Erdogan and Trump have had several meetings, usually very cordial. Trump has praised him, although it's not quite clear he knows who he's praising often. But, you know, they've had these cordial meetings. There was a phone call in which Erdogan made the ask of Trump that he wanted U.S. troops to be removed from Syria. Apparently, Trump immediately said, okay, but let's do that. Erdogan was taken a bit aback by that. He wasn't expecting that kind of response. So I think there's been a problem
but in that got reversed,
the
didn't
promises
it?
That yeah. are made.
Sure, but that got reversed quickly, didn't it?
It did get reversed, right? Yeah. But it's indicative of a larger problem. One of the reasons that Erdogan has pushed forward with the F-400 missile defense system purchase from Russia is he believes, sources are telling us, that Trump is going to give him an out, that he's going to give him some kind of loophole such that they will still be able to participate in the F-35. So this is indicative of a larger problem of promises being made between two leaders and then not necessarily following through on them. And frankly, the fact that the U.S. hasn't had an ambassador to Turkey for the past few years has also been extremely problematic. You know, these problems, it's not just the Gulen issue, it's not just the S-400s, it's not just the YPG, the U.S. arming the YPG in Syria. There's a myriad of sort of issues that have become extremely contentious between the U.S. and Turkey that I don't think can be resolved simply by the two leaders meeting. I think that that's a start, but there has to be some kind of translation into that on the ground as well.
But in terms of Syria, with the end game underway, there's no way in the world that Erdogan's hands are clean. Him and the MIT, the intelligence service, set up an underground railroad for jihadis to come and fight in Syria. The YPG, the Kurdish Peshmerga in Syria, who've been the boots on the ground for the Americans, they're the ones that have rounded up the remnants of ISIS and are holding them in camps. And one of the bizarre things of Trump, and this is actually why the Secretary of Defense resigned, Jim Mattis, was the idea that he was just going to let all those people loose and cut the funds to the YPG, who are doing us a massive favor in holding these people until they can figure out whether they're going to come back and kill us. I mean, it's unbelievable, the reckless nature of Trump's foreign policy. We've just seen that with vis-a-vis what's going on in the Gulf now with Iran. So
absolutely,
there's no way in the world that I would trust Erdogan as far as I could throw him. But do you think at the end of the day he's going to get the message that he should back off, particularly in terms of the YPG? Or he seems to be obsessed that he wants to crush them and wants to repopulate the southern border with Sunnis.
Well, I wouldn't trust either Trump or Erdogan as far as I can throw them. And the important point to recognize is the reason that the U.S. decided to arm the YPG, which, by the way, was a initiative as part of the outgoing Obama administration. And then the Trump administration decided to go through with that. Is that Turkey refused to contribute troops and even to allow the U.S. to use Incirlik Air Base in the fight against ISIS. So Turkey said, no, we're not going to be a part of it, because Turkey wanted to make its participation contingent on the U.S. removing Bashar al-Assad, who became one of Erdogan's enemy number ones after having been actually quite good friends. That's sort of a pattern. And so one of the things that we've seen is that the sort of Turkish fight against the YPG has actually gotten him a lot of nationalist support at home. So with all of these elections that we've seen Turkey going through, and my goodness, there's been a lot of elections over the past few years, he's able to rally the ethnic nationalist vote, the secular nationalist vote, all of these individuals who see, rightly so, the YPG in Syria as intricately tied to the PKK in Turkey. So from Turkey's perspective, it has a NATO ally who is arming a terrorist group that is carrying out terrorist attacks on Turkish soil. So from Turkey's perspective, this doesn't make any sense either. And so that's been one of the reasons why Turkey has been pushing back so vociferously. They see it as an act of betrayal, essentially. Now, there is also the problem of the Syrian refugees. So Turkey really played quite a lot of domestic politics in Syria. You alluded to, having open borders, allowing fighters to flow through. There was also the assistance that went to al-Nusra, which formerly an affiliate of al-Qaeda. So Turkey played a lot of domestic politics in Syria and now is kind of seeing the effects of all of that. And, you know, we've seen from Mattis to Brett McGurk, who also resigned over Trump's policy, and now Jim Jeffrey trying to sort this out. A number of officials with, you know, a lot of experience have been trying to figure out how to solve the Syria question. And of course, you have to remember that Russia is a big part of this as well.
Well, that's a conversation for another day. Because you've got the meeting with Bolton and the Russian National Security Advisor, Nikolai Petrushev, and Israel's National Security Advisor. I think it's going on today for some kind of grand bargain in Syria. So we'll hopefully we can have another conversation. Liesl Hintze, I thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much. I enjoyed it very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Liesl Hintze, who's a professor of international relations at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, who studies the intersection of identity politics and foreign policy with a focus on Turkey and the greater Middle East. And her latest book is Identity Politics Inside Out, National Identity Contestation and Foreign Policy in Turkey. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back with an economic analysis of the impact of Bernie Sanders' plan announced today to cancel all $1.6 trillion of student loan debt held by 45 million Americans. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Marshall Steinbaum, who is a professor of economics at the University of Utah and a former research economist at the Center for Equitable Growth. He's the co-author of a recent report at the Levy Economics Institute, The Macroeconomic Effects of Student Debt Cancellation. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marshall Steinbaum.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And what do you make of Senator Bernie Sanders' proposal today to eliminate $1.6 trillion of student debt held by 45 million Americans here in the United States? This is part of a package that would also make public universities, community colleges, and trade schools tuition-free.
Well, I think this is long overdue, frankly. I think that a lot of the rising anger about student debt and feelings of hopelessness and retiring it and paying it off and getting on with your economic life have demanded a response from policymakers. And I think we're seeing that in this as this presidential campaign develops.
So tell us about it from the point of view of an economist, because my understanding is that saddling young Americans with debt before they even get a job, and in fact, in many ways, indenturing them for life, particularly with these crooked for-profit colleges, that you end up with a worthless diploma and a lifetime of debt. Obviously, that's the most egregious side of this bigger picture. But in general, it doesn't make any economic sense, does it, to indenture young Americans before they get a job, because they won't be able to buy cars, refrigerators, furnish houses, buy houses for that matter. And doesn't this, as an economist, make no sense?
Well, I think the assumption underlying the enormous expansion of the federal student loan program over the last decade or two has been that the student debt basically pays for itself, because it buys you more education, and that that increase in education pays off in the form of higher earnings in the labor market. So the narrative that you just outlined, I think, at least until recently, the typical response would have been, well, no, it's actually not bad for the economy. In fact, it's good for the economy because these people are better educated. They have the skills necessary for today's jobs, and those skills are rewarded in the labor market, and that makes the debt affordable. In some ways, no matter how much you take on, I mean, I would say at the extreme limit, you know, this kind of has a self-reinforcing power to it that has encouraged policymakers to extend the student loans to kind of any possible program and institution, to make lots of institutions eligible for the program that really are not providing a very valuable education, as you alluded to. I think beyond the issues of the for-profit institutions and the many credentials available on the market that don't really do anything for a lot of the people who are taking on a great deal of debt to pay for them, there's just sort of this overall ideology that what causes people to earn more in their jobs is the amount of education they have, the amount of skills that they have. And that's really where I think the policy error in expanding the student loan program has taken place. As people have indeed expanded or increased the amount of higher education they obtain, the earnings associated with any given level of higher education have been declining. And that kind of mechanism, what I've called trying to go up a down escalator, has given rise to this just sort of ballooning student debt amounts while people feel less and less able to pay it off. So that's where you get this kind of sense that there's a student debt crisis, and I think where the politicians have now gone kind of bypasses in some ways the literature among most policy experts who sort of cling to the idea that the student debt is paying for itself in terms of higher earnings.
Well, but let's get real. The debt is held by bankers or Wall Street people that make enormous profits. I know students that have gone into law schools and medical schools, and they spend decades just paying off the interest, let alone getting to the principal. They may not get out of debt for 20, 30 years of their professional lives. And this means that the lender ends up making 1,000+% profit. Obviously, this is a good racket for the people that are lending the money, but it's not good for...
I think we should clarify sort of some of the mechanics of how the student loan program works now. So ever since 2008 or 2009, the originator of almost all original student debt is the federal government. They're the lender. So we used to have a a more privatized system where the security was guaranteed by the federal government, but it was private lending institutions that were actually originating the loans. Now the federal government is the creditor for north of 90% of the outstanding debt. It is true that there are private lenders who are still in the market and quite active for the people with the highest outstanding balances. So what you're talking about, the picture of law school students, for example, taking on six figures of debt and paying it off over the course of a lifetime, is true for a subset of the market. But you know, we should understand that it's the federal government that is the creditor for most of it. For where the private lenders are sort of most active is in the places that are most profitable because they have the least risk. So the people that are in their portfolio for the most part are people who are going to make those payments, the law students that you're referring to, and that makes lending a lot of money to people who you're pretty sure is going to pay it off to be a fairly high value proposition. I think where a lot of the attention in the student debt crisis is more focused is on people who take out less total amount of debt but have severe problems paying it off, or at least rising problems paying it off. And I think the kind of revelations in this sphere are people who even complete their degrees. So for a long time, the view has been, well, if people are having trouble paying off their student debt, that's probably because they didn't finish their degree. And because they didn't finish their degree, they didn't realize the increase in earnings that you get from completing a college degree. And so the sort of solution to the problem is to try to get more people to actually stay in school, to in some ways keep paying in the form of taking on more debt, paying tuition, but at least if they get to the other end, that sets them up in a better professional situation to be able to pay it off. I think in the last couple of years, it's become clear that the problems with repayment extend way beyond people who don't complete their degrees. And that really puts, as I was suggesting before, puts the kind of overall philosophy of what this program is supposed to be doing, that is qualifying workers for the needs of today's jobs, that puts that into severe question. And, you know, notwithstanding the fact that the more education you have, generally the higher earnings you'll obtain, that is more caused by outcomes for people with lower educational credentials to become absolutely terrible. So if you want a job at all, or a job that pays more than minimum wage, you sort of have to have some form of higher education credential. That higher education credential, now that there's been severe state disinvestment from higher education institutions, and we've shifted the cost from the public, from employers, from institutions onto individuals. So coming into contact with higher education means that you're almost certainly going to have to take on debt, where at the same time, those educational credentials don't get you the same kind of payoff in the labor market that they once did. And you're there kind of as a hamster on a hamster wheel, so to speak, trying to run to keep up with it.
And again, I'm speaking with Marshall Steinbaum, who's a professor of economics at the University of Utah and a former research economist at the Center for Equitable Growth. He's the co-author of a recent report at the Levy Economics Institute, The Macroeconomic Effects of Student Debt Cancellation. Well, today, Bernie Sanders, in announcing this debt forgiveness of $1.6 trillion in student debt held here in the United States by 45 million Americans. And of course, he went on to say that it would be a part of a package that would make public universities, community colleges, and trade schools tuition free. The way that he plans to have this paid for is a tax on Wall Street. And he made the case that the public, the American taxpayer, bailed out Wall Street in 2008, 2009, and it's about time for them to give something back. Now, when you made the case that the federal government is the lender, up to 90% of student debt is held by the federal government, did the federal government make a profit?
Yeah, no, they definitely do.
How does it compare to the private profit that I was talking about? Because I'm aware of students who are indentured for decades in law schools and in medical schools.
Yeah, so I don't want to draw too much of a distinction. I mean, it's a bit more or less the same idea, you know, as with any financial type of business model. You yourself, the federal government, or the financial institution is borrowing money for a lower interest rate and then lending it out at a higher interest rate. And that's true of both the private student debt and the public and the federal student debt. The federal government borrows at a lower rate than pretty much any financial institution, and they also lend at a lower rate. So I think one important way to understand student loan system as it exists now in this country is that by credit market standards, it's a fairly generous one. That is, the government thinks that more people should be educated, and so they will give you a loan to pay for your education on substantially more favorable terms, especially to low credit borrowers, than they would ever be able to get from a private lender. Where the private lenders make their money is more or less lending to people who would definitely get credit regardless, either from the government or from private lenders, because they're good credit risks. So the federal government is lending on generous terms, but then the federal government is also in some ways the most onerous creditor on the back end. So they have, in some cases, you know, the power to garnish your wages, the power to essentially enforce collections, and follow you around. They know where you are more easily than private lenders. And so the federal government's business model differs from the private lenders because they're able to swallow a higher risk of delinquency because they are, you know, can kind of put the full force of the state behind making you pay and you know, knowing where you are, knowing what your assets are, and encumbering them. You know, the interesting thing I think to understand about the federal system is while the federal government does make a substantial profit off of its student loan portfolio, in some ways that gets in the way of, I think, sound policy because, you know, as we're suggesting, they want to lend out more. They want people to get an education. They also want to force people to pay it back even when it's really bad for the borrower to be forced to pay it back. You know, the government is all, you know, kind of in the business of forcing more people into the pipeline of higher education because, you know, whether you want to believe that because of, for altruistic reasons, that means that the government believes that means that you'll be better off over the course of your life cycle, or if you want to take the cynical view that they're just as bad a lender as anybody else, and they want you to borrow money from them so that you then have to pay it back at a, you know, at a higher interest rate. You know, you don't have to take a stand on that one way or another to see that this is a somewhat perverse position for the federal government to be in. I tend to take a more benign view. I don't think that they're at least, well, I can't really speak for this education secretary and the administration she's running, but, you know, because it seems more in the hawk to the most exploitative types of institutions. It's also worth noting that the servicers, so these are the former student lenders who used to take a principal position in originating student debt. When the federal government took over that business from them and became the lender itself, it kind of carved out this business of servicing the debt, trying to collect it from people, telling people how much they owe, and generally acting as the sort of interface between the government as lender and the borrowers themselves. You know, the servicers get a nice cut of the proceeds. So some of the sort of political and economic impetus for keeping student debt as onerous as possible, sort of forcing people to remain in the situation of having to pay off their debt as their first priority, not being able to undertake other economic activities like buying a house or starting a family, you know, that sustains the servicer business model as well, because, you know, if you're kind of faithfully making your monthly payments, then the servicer is making a profit off of you.
Well, but surely, Marshall Steinbaum, something has to explain that this millennial generation, this indentured generation that I'm talking about here, student debt has ballooned from $90 billion to $1.6 trillion in only two decades. That's according to federal data. So something has happened. What is it?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I think what's happened is that the labor market has not been operating the way it should be. I think it's hard to find a job. I think what we've been telling people is the way to find a job is to get the right kind of skills. And the way to get the right kind of skills is to obtain higher education credentials and to finance that with student debt. So all these people who are way more encumbered with student debt now than they would have been had they been born in earlier generations have done as they're told, as far as I'm concerned, by policymakers, by experts who believed that this would be rewarded in the labor market. And it turns out that was wrong. It was just a straight up misinterpretation of the way that the labor market functions. Instead of increasing the amount of skills and therefore the earnings that people get, what we did was credentialize the labor market and devalue the value of any one credential. And that in turn sparked people to need to get more. And I think this is a particularly acute to discuss in the context of racial inequality because, one, it's been documented that one of the kind of mechanisms that racial minorities use to navigate discrimination and lower pay and greater difficulty in finding a job is to obtain higher educational credentials than white counterparts and definitely to obtain those credentials using more debt than their white counterparts. So, for example, we've seen that while black undergraduates leaving four-year degrees, leaving university, leave with $7,000 more debt than their white counterparts. Presumably that's explainable through differing family backgrounds, greater wealth among white parents than black parents. Over the course of 7 years following graduation, the differential between white and black undergraduates increases to $25,000. And the reason why is because the white undergraduates are able to find a job. That job tends to be relatively high paying, and they can start to pay down their student debt according to the 10-year timescale that is the standard federal student loan contract. Whereas black undergraduates have greater trouble finding a job. The jobs that they find pay less, and as a result of that, especially, they tend to go back for more degrees and therefore more debt. So white people paying down their debt from whatever level it is coming out of undergrad, black people taking on more debt, at, you know, let alone not paying down the debt that they have from undergrad due to labor market discrimination and other inequities. And this gives rise to kind of yet another ratchet to the racial wealth gap that exists and proliferates across generations.
Well, in two decades, to go from $90 billion of student debt to $1.6 trillion, I can't do the math, but that's what seems like over 100-fold. I mean, it's an amazing jump. And
right. Well, there's been a huge reduction in state support for higher education institutions. I think that also has a racial flavor to it, that state governments perceive constituents for higher education spending as looking very different than the state tax base. And so there's been a political effort at the state level to shift the cost of higher education from the state to individuals. You know, you would think that just due to that, you'd get fewer people going into higher education because, you know, now it costs a lot more. But the reality has been the opposite. In fact, more and more people keep going into higher education despite the fact that it costs more. It's student debt that makes that possible, and it's the fact that the outcomes available if you don't go obtain any higher education credentials in this labor market are just absolutely abysmal. So it's sort of you're badly off if you take on student debt to get a higher education degree, but you're even worse off if you don't take on student debt to get a higher education degree. And that kind of rat race type mechanism is driving the ballooning of the total student loan amounts that you're referring to.
Well, just in closing in the last minute, obviously there's a political dimension to this with the Democratic presidential candidates debate on Wednesday and Thursday, at which Senator Elizabeth Warren will be on Wednesday. Pretty much obviously going to be dominating with the candidates aren't doing as well as her. That's the expectation. And Bernie Sanders will be on the following day, Thursday, with a lot more of the top-tier candidates duking it out, I guess. But Elizabeth Warren is proposing $640 billion in student debt forgiveness as opposed to Bernie Sanders' announcement today of $1.6 trillion. She's also apparently, according to pollsters, doing well or on the rise at Bernie's expense. So how do you think this is going to play out politically?
Well, I don't want to get into too much of the sort of horse race between the two of them. I think it's a positive development kind of no matter what's going on, and I'm glad that both of them are clearly paying a great deal of attention to the problem of the student debt crisis and the potential for political solutions to it. I think, you know, if we're sort of comparing the two plans as on the table, my impression was that the Warren proposal, you know, rules out canceling all of the debt of people who, according to the campaign, earn a high income, whereas the Sanders proposal doesn't. And, you know, to my mind, that's even though the headline numbers are very different as a result of that, the overall aim of the overall effect of the policy is not really that different if you're basically financing the policy with a severe progressive taxation, which I think both candidates are. So it seems to me that there's sort of a political judgment going on between canceling all versus canceling most and canceling all of the debt for, you know, the vast majority of borrowers that, you know, does it basically is the program on the table canceling the debt of high earners within itself, or in which case, you know, is that going to be financed by taxing those earners, those high earners, or alternatively, is it only going to be canceling the debt of relatively lower earners, or at least all the debt of lower earners and only some of the debt of higher earners? And I think in the grand scheme of things, that distinction doesn't matter all that much.
Well, Marcia Steinbaum, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Yes, it's been great. Glad we could do it.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Marshall Steinbaum, who's professor of economics at the University of Utah and a former research economist at the Center for Equitable Growth. And he's the co-author of a recent report at the Levy Economics Institute, The Macroeconomic Effects of Student Debt Cancellation. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.